It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin poet tells us about her new collection of haiku that she wrote while undergoing testing and treatment in a hospital. First, some blue states are passing laws that expand the number of health care providers able to perform abortions. That's part of their preparation for an influx of out-of-state patients, with the possibility of Roe v. Wade being overturned this summer. Illinois is one of those states. It passed a law in 2019 making access to reproductive health care, including abortion, a legal right in the state. Here's Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker at a Planned Parenthood clinic in the state reacting to the leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade.
Since 2015, the number of out-of-state patients coming to Illinois to make their own decisions about whether, where, and how to be a parent has tripled. And without action from Congress, it's set to soar. When women come here to this state, you are welcomed in Illinois. You are supported. You are safe. You won't need to suffer additional trauma. You'll be treated with dignity and empathy and compassion.
With divided government and an existing abortion ban on the books from 1849, Wisconsin most likely won't move in a similar direction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If Roe is overturned, many people will have to travel to other states if they want to seek an abortion. What are your thoughts on that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter for Politico covering the Capitol Hill beat. Alice, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
We're hearing a lot in the news, Alice, about states passing new restrictions, including today Oklahoma, it looks like. How widespread are these states trying to make abortion more accessible right now?
So because of the makeup of which party controls state legislatures and governorships right now, the bulk of the action is definitely on the side that wants to ban and restrict access to abortion. However, as you noted, you know, Illinois, California, many other states that are more progressive and supportive of abortion rights are moving in that direction. And it's a sort of a multi-front campaign. They're both trying to pass more legal protections for abortion rights that can apply to not only state residents, but those who might come from out of state. But also, you know, they know that having a legal right on paper doesn't necessarily mean people will be able to obtain an abortion if they want one. We've seen that for decades. You know, even with Roe versus Wade on the books, abortion has become inaccessible for millions of people in the country. And so a lot of states are also taking steps to remove financial barriers to the procedure. And expand the number of people who are trained to actually provide abortions, because there's a concern of shortages on that front as well.
And a recent piece you wrote keyed in on that last issue. You just mentioned the idea of changing laws to expand the number of providers who can legally provide abortions. What kind of things are we seeing in states that are doing that?
That's right. So this is something that some states did a long time ago, but with the increased attention on this issue and the expectation that the Supreme Court will soon overturn Roe versus Wade, which will clear the way for, you know, potentially dozens of states to enact bans, the expectation is that a lot of people will be traveling to the states that maintain abortion rights. And there's a concern that because there are so few trained abortion providers, that the current clinics will be just completely inundated and overwhelmed, and that will cause delays. And that will impact not only the people who are coming in from out of state, but also the people who live in these states. And so, you know, for a while, there's sort of been this feeling from a lot of places that, you know, this is a red state problem. This won't affect me, but this will absolutely affect everyone. And so you have states, you know, most recently Maryland, but several others have looked at allowing more kinds of medical workers to provide abortions early in pregnancy, especially. So that's nurse practitioners, midwives, other so-called advanced practice clinicians. Illinois has not done that yet, but they are under pressure to do so because they are surrounded by so many states that are expected to enact bans.
And things vary from state to state. Can you talk about, on a practical level, how these laws would do this? Would they allow those different categories you just mentioned, the nurse practitioners or midwives or physician assistants, to do any abortion procedure, or are they allowed to do some, but surgeons required to do others? How would this work in practice?
So yes, it varies state to state, and we have a handy map in our report that folks can look up showing what the laws are in each state. And so some allow these non-physicians to do both medication abortions, so literally just prescribing someone a pill, which is only you can do within the first 10 weeks of pregnancy, as well as procedural abortions, again, early in pregnancy. And what we are hearing from medical groups like the World Health Organization and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is that they support allowing this because they, you know, it's been studied. This is something California has allowed for several years now. And so there's data showing it's, you know, just as safe as having doctors do this. And also, folks argue that having these earlier, more straightforward procedures and cases be handled by non-physicians frees up the small number of trained physicians to handle the more complex cases that might need more attention.
Talking to Alice Miranda Olstein from Politico, looking at states, some states around the country looking to make abortion more accessible in the event of the overturning of Roe v. Wade later this year. And Alice, there is, of course, opposition. First of all, groups opposed to abortion in the states that are passing these laws. What kind of things did you hear from them?
Yes, so there has been some pushback from the medical community. You know, they tend to be very territorial about so-called scope of practice issues. There have been lots of legal fights around, you know, non-physicians giving vaccinations and flu shots. And so these kind of arguments are nothing new. And medical groups tend to be defensive of their turf, of their members' turf. But we found in our reporting that really most of the pushback is coming from anti-abortion conservatives, not from medical groups. And so you have testifying against these proposals in different states. It's mainly coming from anti-abortion advocacy groups.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thank you for this discussion. I'm in favor of Roe v. Wade being overturned. I like the idea that the power would go back to the states to decide the legality of abortion. My only thought is the best way to prevent an abortion is to not get pregnant. And, you know, there's other ways of being sexually active without causing pregnancy. Thank you.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Alice, did you encounter any, as part of these efforts, pregnancy prevention sex education initiatives rolled into some of these reactions to the potential overturning of Roe v. Wade?
So I've been recently reporting on how access to contraception is quite bad in a lot of the country, especially for low-income people. And there are a lot of things Congress and the Biden administration could do to address that they have not done. Also things states could do that they have not done. And these states that are most likely to ban abortion are seemingly the least likely to take action on making contraception better available.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Alice, a lot of what you wrote about in that piece I mentioned earlier involves states getting ready for people crossing state lines to get abortions. There have been efforts in some states so far, I don't know if they've been successful, to pass bans on exactly that, on people traveling out of the affected state to seek abortion care in other states. Is that something that came up as a concern as you were looking at states that are trying to expand access?
So, yes, and you've seen more progressive states specifically taking actions, you know, in anticipation of those kinds of efforts. And so you've seen California, for instance, and Connecticut and a few others extending legal protections in the event that another state, either the state itself or individual private parties try to sort of reach across state borders and bring charges against people. So we haven't actually had any state successfully pass such a policy to try to ban travel or allow that kind of prosecution across state lines, but it's definitely of a high concern given that so many people are already traveling. I think what is happening in Texas is a very fair preview of what we are likely to see in a lot of the country, where lots and lots of people are leaving the state for the procedure because of the ban that's in place now.
And briefly, a lot of the people from Texas had been going, I understand, to Oklahoma. Now there's the new Oklahoma law coming into effect. Looking at your map, how far are people potentially going to have to travel if they want to go to another state to seek an abortion?
Right. So, you know, you're really seeing a spillover effect because Oklahoma was the place that Texas patients were going to most. And now that is going to be cut off. And so it'll just ripple further and further out, which is why I've been reporting on concerns that the abortion clinics in the states that maintain access are set to be overwhelmed unless they take steps now to expand their workforce, provide training, and sort of be ready to handle the patient load that could be coming.
Alice, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter for Politico covering the Capitol Hill beat. She talked to us about legislation in some blue states aimed at increasing access to abortion. Coming up, a Wisconsin writer shares a new collection of poems that she composed while undergoing treatment in hospitals and clinics, and how poetry has helped her cope with long-term illness. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Congress is weighing a new aid package for Ukraine, and President Biden is backing Finland and Sweden in their bid to join NATO. We'll talk to a Wisconsin expert about the latest on the war in Ukraine. Now, you may remember learning about, maybe even writing haiku back in school. The poems, inspired by a Japanese tradition, look simple, but they can pack a lot of punch into just a few lines. Our next guest turned to haiku to deal with and to share her experiences with long-term illness and disability. She composed her poems in MRI machines, infusion centers, and waiting rooms. Ellen Samuels is professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison and the author of Fantasies of Identification, Disability, Gender, Race. Ellen's latest book is a collection of haiku called Hypermobilities. I talked to her earlier this year. Well, your book dives right into haiku, and I was hoping you could share some of the first section with us called Hypermobility.
Yes. So there's seven poems in each section, seven haiku, so I'll just read them from this first section. The first poem is called Hypermobility. No one is supposed to bend that far. No one knows why you don't just break. Baton hypermobility scale. Thumb, wrist, palm on floor. All the ways you go too far. Tally up your score. The difference between joint subluxation and dislocation. Door unlatched in the body house. Shutter to slow kiss the jam or slam. Hypermobility of the small joints. To press a button means fingers, muscle, past bone. Yes, no, enter, yes. Hypermobility of the large joints. If your legs were wings, they need to swing this far out, and feathers, and sky. Hypermobility of the large joints too. Don't climb a hill, then pick up leaves. Too much bending, I mean ambition. Hypermobility of the large joints three. The ankle joint is connected to the leg joint. That's enough for now.
Now, before we talk more about the poetry and how you wrote it, can you tell us a little bit about this chronic condition, hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, if I'm pronouncing that all correctly?
Yeah, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is named after the two doctors who first described it. So one doctor's last name was Ehlers and one was Danlos. It is an inherited collagen defect. Collagen is one of the building blocks of our bodies. So this collagen defect affects all the systems of the body in a variety of ways. But the most hallmark way and often the most visible way is that it causes what they call hypermobility in joints. The ligaments that are supposed to hold your joints in place are weakened by this disorder. And so joints can slip out of place, can, as they say, medically subluxate, which is like a partial dislocation or dislocate, just from the tiniest movement. Can dislocate my shoulder just, you know, turning over in bed. And Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is considered a rare disorder, but in recent years, it's being diagnosed much, much more often, and it's beginning to be thought it was more of an underdiagnosed but more common syndrome rather than being as rare as was once thought.
You've been living with this for a long time, pre- and post-diagnosis, lots of treatment. What started you coming up with these haiku about it?
Yeah, it started in 2014 when I was diagnosed with a complication of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which was a dissection in one of the arteries going to my brain. I spent a lot of time in MRI machines, getting head and neck MRIs. And that's quite an intense experience in any case, but in my case, they were often, it was in a very emergency setting, which was more stressful. And it's very loud in the MRI machines. They give you little headphones with music, but you can't really hear the music because the machine is so loud. And I needed something to kind of hold on to get through these hours in the machines. And so I started to write haiku in my head because it was such a short form that I could write it in my head without, you know, being able to write on any form of writing implement. And I started doing that as well when I was getting other treatments, spending time in the infusion centers at the hospital with different drugs. And it just really helped center me and give me a sense of control when things felt very out of control. And that's why I really hewed very strictly to the 5-7-5 syllabus form, which isn't even, I think, by haiku experts considered quote unquote real haiku at this point. But for me, it was really essential to the experience.
When did this go, Ellen, from basically a coping mechanism to something you realized you wanted to share with the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. At a certain point, I started writing them down in a document on my computer, and occasionally posting one on social media. And I think when I had about 20 or 25 haiku was when I started to think maybe these are more than a coping mechanism. Maybe I'm actually writing a book and it's kind of a memoir in haiku about this experience. I have an MFA in creative writing from Cornell University. I've wrote and published poetry a lot early in my career, but more recently I had not written and published poetry in a long time. And so it was probably, you know, after a couple of years of doing this that I started to turn it into a book. And then it was just published this year, which I'm really excited about.
Talking to Ellen Samuels, professor at UW-Madison, author of the new book we're talking about, a collection of poems, haiku, called Hypermobilities. I want to talk about this for a couple different audiences, Ellen. First of all, for people with disabilities, what are you hoping that they take out of your, as you say, your memoir in haiku form?
I'm glad you asked that because, I mean, the disability community is the community that has sustained me through my experience both before and after diagnosis as a person with significant physical disabilities. And so for my community, I hope to say first and foremost always, you're not alone. It's tremendously isolating to have any kind of disability, to have any kind of chronic illness. You often feel very cut off from the world. And so I see all my writing as different ways to connect with that community and say, you're not alone. Here's my experience. Is my experience useful to you? Just as so many others' writers' experiences have been so profoundly useful for me.
And then for people not dealing with a chronic illness or a disability, or at least not yet, I guess, Ellen, one line that stuck out in your afterword to the book, quoting, "I don't want to be pitied, but I also don't want to pretend everything is okay." That struck me. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's really the bind that you're in with any kind of chronic illness, I think, is that how do you answer the question, how are you? Beyond if you just you give the automatic okay, right? If you tell the truth, then the automatic reaction is some kind of pity or or otherwise putting you, you know, assigning you to a category of someone who is damaged in some way, and that healthy people want to distinguish themselves from, right? We literally have, you know, expressions like "there, but for the grace of God, go I," or like, you know, well, if I see that Ellen, with everything she's dealing with, you know, can do this, then I shouldn't complain. That seems like an uplifting sentiment at first, but it's actually a profoundly dehumanizing one in a way, because it suggests that we are not the same kind of people. And I just have to observe that I think this is true at all times. It was true when I wrote the book pre the COVID-19 pandemic, but certainly during the pandemic, it's becoming clear that we are all vulnerable. We are all physically, mentally, and emotionally interdependent, linked, and vulnerable people who cannot divide ourselves into the worlds of so easily of who's healthy and who is not.
In our last minute or so, Ellen, for getting back to others in the disability community now, would you encourage them to join you and I think a growing number of people with disabilities who are expressing themselves in poetry, in prose, in whatever form?
I do. I do encourage everyone to write or create in the way that works for you. There are, of course, Instagram poets. That's not something I could ever do, but I think if that works for people and it reaches people, it's great. I've had the great privilege of teaching writing in a variety of settings for the last few decades. And one of the most amazing things is to see someone who says, "I've never even thought to write a poem in my life. What is a poem?" And then by the end of the semester have discovered in themselves this rich, beautiful poetic voice they didn't know was there. I think writing is a gift, but it's also a skill that can be learned and that everyone can do it.
It's a great place to leave it. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of your poetry.
Thanks for having me.
Ellen Samuels is professor of gender and women's studies in English at UW-Madison. I talked to her earlier this year about her new book of haiku poetry. It's called Hyper Mobilities. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a political scientist about what's happening in the war in Ukraine and a new aid package just passed by Congress. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, two historians join the show to answer a recent Why Wisconsin question about the history of racially restrictive sundown towns here in Wisconsin. Now, the U.S. Senate passed a foreign aid package today that would give $40 billion to Ukraine for military assistance and humanitarian and economic relief. Meanwhile, President Biden showed his support today for Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Both countries have turned from years of precedent to seek membership since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This all comes as the war in Ukraine continues to grind on with no obvious path to peace. Do you think the U.S. should continue to financially help Ukraine during this war? What do you think of this new package of aid, military and otherwise? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also, do you have questions about two previously neutral countries, Finland and Sweden, seeking to join NATO? What's confusing you right now about the war in Ukraine? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison, specializing in international security topics, including terrorism and war and peace. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
A lot going on in Ukraine right now. Ukraine surrendering at Mariupol after a long siege there. More sanctions on Russia. Russia being turned back in other places. In a nutshell, what do you see as the status of the invasion right now?
Well, it settled into a war of attrition in the east. The Russians gave up on capturing the big cities, the capital, Kyiv in the north, and Kharkiv in the northeast of the country. The Ukrainians have pushed them back there. But now they've reinforced their positions and are trying to capture more territory in the far east, in the regions around Donetsk and Luhansk, where they had a separatist presence before the war got started back in February. And that progress has been slow. They've made some progress. They've made advances incrementally, but they haven't been able to make the big gains and the big encirclements that they were hoping to achieve and destroy, you know, large chunks of the Ukrainian army. So with that being beyond them, they've been making small incremental gains, and the Ukrainians have been fighting back in small ways as well. So it's settled into a kind of a long war of attrition.
Now we have this new aid package passed now by the Senate, going to President Biden. It had already passed the House. About half of this $40 billion for direct military aid, also economic and humanitarian relief. How much difference does military aid of about $20 billion make to the Ukrainian war effort?
I think it makes an enormous difference. I think you've seen in the recent battles in the East how that aid has been put to use pretty rapidly. There's a big battle earlier in the week over this river crossing where the Russians tried to cross a river in the eastern region in Donetsk, the Donetsk area. And the Ukrainians were able to target artillery fire on that and basically destroy their pontoon bridges and a lot of the armored vehicles on the other side of the river. So it turned into a major defeat for the Russians. And that's the kind of thing that you really need artillery to cope with. From the earliest days of the war, we've been giving them these shoulder-mounted anti-tank weapons, both the American Javelin and some other European versions, as well as Stinger anti-aircraft style missiles. But those are relatively short range. You have to be sort of within sight of the target for the most part. Artillery, you can hit targets that are 5, 10, 15 kilometers behind the front line. And so that's what you really need to engage forces that are over the horizon, out of sight. And the Ukrainians have been putting those to great use recently. And that's very artillery intensive, very ammunition intensive. You need to have a steady supply of shells to keep that going. And I think that's what the Ukrainians need at this point.
There's been a fair amount of bipartisan support for this aid package. Most Republicans in the Senate did support it, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He said in this interview with PBS NewsHour, he supports the package. He's hoping to see more aid and more action, he says, from President Biden.
The president really needs to step up his game. He has frequently done the right thing, but never soon enough. We now know where we are. The Russians are in the country. We need to do everything we can to give them the tools to fight with. Many of these tools are in the hands of Eastern European NATO allies who are anxious to help.
So even with a bipartisan bill, Senator McConnell, they're critical of the Biden administration. Do you think that the Biden administration could have done more faster to facilitate the flow of aid to Ukraine?
Possibly in some ways around the margins, but I think mostly that's a product of, I mean, he's the leader of the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, so he needs to find something to be critical of. But I think the main message to be drawn from it is the bipartisan support for the aid to Ukraine. It's really only a small number of Republicans in Congress who've been oppositional to it. So you've seen a kind of a rare window or rare episode of an issue where you've got fairly wide bipartisan agreement on in terms of aiding Ukraine, giving them the weapons they need to fight, and trying to compensate for some of the economic damage that's occurring at the same time. So I think that's really the main takeaway there.
Talking to Andrew Kidd from UW-Madison, looking at the latest news in Ukraine, a big aid package passed by Congress, going to President Biden now for a signature, aiming military and economic and humanitarian aid to Ukraine, also to, if you'd said this a year ago, two surprising countries trying to become part of NATO now. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your ideas about how the U.S. should or shouldn't support Ukraine right now. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Just mentioned Finland and Sweden seeking to join NATO now. I want to give a listen to President Biden saying earlier today he wants to see this happen.
Finnish and Swedish troops have already serve shoulder to shoulder with U.S. and NATO forces in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, and in Iraq. And both Finland and Sweden are already working in coordination with the United States and our other allies and partners to support the brave people of Ukraine as they defend their freedom against Russia's invasion.
Andrew, as I'm reading stuff, it seems like if I'd said a year ago, yeah, Finland and Sweden are going to seek to join NATO soon, it would have sounded like just wacky talk. It very unlikely. Can you talk about how big a change this is for those two countries?
Oh, it's an enormous change, all right. Those countries have been neutral, not just for in the post-Cold War era, but throughout the Cold War and even before. Sweden was neutral during World War II and was one of the few countries not to be invaded by the Nazis. And they took that as a lesson that neutrality works for them, and they maintained their neutrality throughout the Cold War. Finland was neutral in a sense. They had fought the Russians to a standstill to some extent in the Finnish War, the Winter War, and the Continuation War, but ultimately realized that they couldn't really go against Russia to any great extent during the Cold War. But thankfully, the Russians were willing to let them be in exchange for not siding with NATO. And so neutrality has worked well for those countries for most of the 20th century. So to get them off of that and into the arms of NATO took a really big shock. And I think that shock, there's both sort of a motivation and a sort of window of opportunity here, in the sense that the motivation is provided by Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which makes Russia look much more aggressive than it used to be and much more threatening to neighboring countries like Finland and Sweden. So that provides the shock and the sort of motivation, the Russian aggression. But the failure of the Russian aggression provides the window of opportunity, in the sense that Russia is now temporarily weakened by this. They've lost big chunks of their military forces in Ukraine. The Ukrainians are continuing to fight them effectively. So Russia is in no position to make any sort of conventional military threat against Finland and Sweden at the moment. But of course, if they were to prevail in Ukraine and win, then they would eventually be able to reallocate their forces and target the North once again. So the Scandinavians have this motivation in fear of Putin and window of opportunity in temporary Russian weakness. So they would like to get into NATO quickly and make that happen so that when this war does end, if Putin were to target his aggression elsewhere, he would meet a unified wall of opposition.
Now, it seems like one of Putin's goals, not just with the Ukraine invasion, but for years, has been to weaken NATO, among other things, by supporting candidates in NATO countries who were less sympathetic, less interested in being active participants in it. So now NATO seems more stronger, unified, and maybe going to grow even more on Russian borders. This seems like a big opposite effect of what Putin would have wanted.
It's definitely an unintended consequence for Russia here, for Putin, the exact opposite of what he was hoping for. He was hoping the invasion of Ukraine would, A, succeed, of course, and enable him to retake Ukraine, but B, sort of scare other countries into being more accommodating of Russian interests and reluctant to join NATO. And it's had the exact opposite effect. It's made them more interested in joining NATO, which could have been predicted, but not by him, I guess. So I think, yeah, that's definitely redounded against his goals there.
Andrew Kidd is with us from UW-Madison, looking at the war in Ukraine, the involvement the U.S. has financially and politically, a new big aid package passed by Congress today, maybe more countries joining NATO. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, the path to peace. Is there a path to peace? What do you think? How do you want to see this resolved ultimately? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. What do you think about U.S. financial support for Ukraine? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Andrew Kidd, political scientist at UW-Madison, talking with us about the possibility of Finland and Sweden joining NATO, a U.S. foreign aid package for Ukraine with military and humanitarian funding, and what kind of path to peace there could be here. You could join in at 800-642-1234. $40 billion package passed by Congress to support Ukraine, military, humanitarian, economic aid. Should we do more? Should we do less? What do you hope comes out of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, before we move on from NATO, again, Finland and Sweden want to join. Most countries receptive. Turkish diplomats seem to be on board, but the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, saying, hold on, slow the roll here. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so Turkey's problem, or Erdogan's problem, is at least the problem he's stating, is that Sweden, and I think particularly Sweden, has some refugees, emigres from Turkey, who are associated with the PKK, which is a Kurdish guerrilla group, which is regarded by the Turkish regime as a terrorist organization, which has fought for Kurdish autonomy inside Turkey over the years. And so that is the problem that he's raising anyway. So I think there's going to be an objection there. It may be a case where that will lead to some intra-alliance negotiations, and eventually his concerns will be assuaged and or bought off in some sense. So at this point, I'm not overly worried that this is going to prevent in the long run this from happening. But he seems to be asking for a little bit of compensation here at the minimum. So we'll see what happens.
Now, we've talked, I think, in the past about opposition to the war in Russia, muted. People can go to jail, of course, for opposing the war in Russia. I've been reading about some recent criticism, though, in Russia of the military operation, not from people who are opposed to it, but because they think it's not big enough, that the solution to Russia's quagmire right now in Ukraine is to go bigger, call up reserves and conscripts, go in with a much bigger army. Do you worry that the response within Russia may be to expand the war?
Yeah, that's always a concern. There's no doubt about that. I'm less concerned that voices that you're hearing on social media matter to somebody like Putin. I mean, from his point of view, I think he could put those people in jail in a heartbeat without any problem. So it's not as if they're going to put actual pressure on Putin to do one thing or another. But there certainly is, there certainly are possibilities of things he could do that are more escalatory than has been done so far, right? He could try to order some sort of general mobilization, call up more people through the draft, so we could get more manpower. And then there's also possibilities of escalating in terms of the types of weapons he uses or the types of targets he attacks, the worst scenario being possible use of nuclear weapons. So there are indeed more aggressive stances he could take. The big question for him, I think, is going to be, does taking those stances make his survival in office more or less likely? It might make it more likely that he prevails in Ukraine, but it might also lead to instability inside Russia. You've already seen recruitment offices for the military being firebombed, and the anti-war sentiment has been effectively muzzled because people simply get arrested right away if they express any anti-war sentiment. But it's out there. It's bubbling underneath the surface, and I think he's aware of that dimly. And so if he were to pursue some dramatic strategy, like calling up large numbers of draftees, I mean, the possibility is that works and they go to Ukraine obediently and fight. And the other possibility is that they start to riot and start marching on the Kremlin or something like that. So there's all kinds of dangers when you're in a situation like Putin faces himself. And it may be that even his own personal survival would be enhanced by reducing the sort of de-escalating rather than escalating in Ukraine.
Now, I'm seeing reports here that General Mark Milley, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff here in the U.S., had a phone call with his Russian counterpart, first time since February, since basically before the invasion. The official statement was that they discussed, quote, several security-related issues of concern and agreed to keep the lines of communication open, end quote. They're not releasing specific details. What is the value? What kind of things can we get out of that kind of conversation between the heads of the militaries of both countries in a tense situation like this?
It's a slightly good sign. I wouldn't make too much of it necessarily. I mean, it's possibly better than nothing at all. But we have to remember, Putin often talks back and forth, and he'll make a reassuring gesture or say something that sounds good, and then go against that a couple of days or a week later and do something escalatory or violent as if he's trying to put people off their guard. You've seen that many times in the current war in Ukraine, leading up to it as well. So I don't put a lot of stock in these sorts of things. Perhaps it's a good idea, though, to have, just as a broad general thing, American military officers and the defense secretary as well, having these channels, direct channels with their Russian counterparts, being willing to pick up the phone could be useful in certain situations if things really did start to escalate dramatically.
We are talking to Andrew Kidd from UW-Madison about the latest in Ukraine after Congress passed a substantial aid package for Ukraine. Still time for your call. If you are following this still, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Andrew, Ukraine doesn't want to give up any of its territory, whether from this invasion or from the past Russian interference in parts of the country. Russia doesn't want to come away from this, I would guess, without getting something with those two things on the table. What could be a path to a peace, to an end to this war?
It's hard to see what the path to peace is at this point. It really is. I think you've laid it out correctly there, that Ukraine wants to fight to regain the territory. Certainly, the territory lost since February of this year in the most recent invasion. And more ambitiously, they might even want to get back Crimea, which was taken from them back in 2014. And the Russians, of course, Putin himself would find it humiliating to get nothing whatsoever for his invasion. So that's a very strong conflict of interest there between the two sides. And in the case that they'll probably continuing to fight it out until it's clear which side is going to win. The other question is, what should U.S. war aims be? There's been a lot of talk lately about how the United States should lean on the Ukrainians to reduce their war aims and be willing to negotiate, be willing to give up territory and some sort of peace settlement with Russia. And I think that's motivated largely by fears of escalation on the Russian side, fears of nuclear escalation in particular. So you have seen some talk along those lines, but most, for the most part, there's, I think, pretty uniform support for Ukraine getting back its territory lost since 2014, or since February of this year, although probably less so for Crimea. So I think right now the United States is still pretty much lined up behind Ukraine and its war aims. There's been talk of more grandiose war aims, which I think is probably not a good idea, from the United States, from occasional American leaders talking about weakening Russia or, you know, regime change in Russia, Putin being overthrown. And those should not be our goals. We should be perfectly happy if we have a restoration of the status quo this year. Putin doesn't have to leave power. We're not seeking any broader weakening of Russia, or at least we shouldn't be, as far as I'm concerned. Conflict resolution, ending this war on favorable terms to Ukraine should be the goal.
And then I just want to spend our last minute or so on the humanitarian situation. Millions of people displaced and left Ukraine, millions more displaced within the country, seeing reports that some people are going back from Poland into Ukraine, you know, in the five-digit numbers, not in the millions. What are you watching for when it comes to the people displaced by this war?
Well, people coming back would be hopeful, and I think it is hopeful. I think people can come back certainly to Kyiv, the capital, and possibly soon to Kharkiv as well, which are the two biggest cities. So that could draw a lot of people back from Poland and from the other Eastern European countries where they've gone, and the internally displaced people as well. I think you're going to see a lot of continuing horror stories coming out of the south and the east, where Russians are being where Ukrainians are being forced into Russia in Russian-occupied areas, where the Russian grip is being tightened on those cities and towns. So I think we're going to see a lot of problems there and a lot of uncertainty about what happens to Ukrainians who have been taken into Russia. And I think we're going to see continuing exposés of mass graves and atrocities in other areas that are liberated by the Ukrainian forces. So I think it's going to continue to tell the tale of a very brutal Russian occupation that is very much not obeying any sort of or making any pretense of obeying or respecting humanitarian or international law in this conflict.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Andrew Kidd, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Andrew specializes in international security topics, including terrorism and war and peace. He talked with us today about the war in Ukraine, the U.S. aid package just passed today by Congress, and the possibility of Finland and Sweden joining NATO after decades of neutrality. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, addiction can be a struggle for family members, and it raises questions about the best ways to help a loved one dealing with addiction. Kate's guest has advice and answers to your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Some good news from Wisconsin's trails. As you may have heard from WPR News, Wisconsin's popular Elroy to Sparta Trail officially reopened last weekend after flooding damage a few years back. The DNR says the 32-mile-long trail gets as many as 60,000 visitors in a year. I also stumbled across a national event with a lot of action here in Wisconsin. June 4th is National Trails Day, organized by hiking groups to get people out on trails and to encourage people to volunteer to help maintain those trails. They've got a map of events up at AmericanHiking.org. I counted 8 around Wisconsin and a couple more right across state lines. One highlight at Kickapoo Valley Reserve in Lafarge, Llama Packing 101, intro and workshop. Yes, hike with a llama. Learn how. Again, find the full event map online at AmericanHiking.org. Hiking and llama news you can use. This is Central Time.